I had a teacher in high school who would often say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. He would also say, when the going gets tough, the fickle go the opposite direction. I don't know if all that had something to do with his exams. I'm not sure, but we know what that's like. I mean, who among us have not experienced that abandonment by friends and associates at the most crucial and critical times of life, or we at the very, very least, we've observed that happen to other people. All of us know what that is like to endure that kind of a difficulty. You know, when the sailing is smooth and when the organization or the club or the family or the business is plodding along or maybe even having a certain amount of success, it really does appear like everybody's on the same page, right? But when the winds turn adversarial, all of that seems to change. Just out of the blue, it seems like all of those friends and all that support just kind of disappears into thin air. How's that happen? Well, here's the easy answer. That's life. Life is like that. You know, life is a series of ebbing and flowing, an awful lot like the tides of the ocean. You know, today you have much support, and so you march off to face the competition and do the best that you possibly can. And tomorrow, when it appears like the competition is a lot stronger than you anticipated and they're actually better than you are, all that support just kind of vanishes. And then the organization or the school or the church or the kingdom, as it is in the case of the story that we're reading, has to drop back and take a hit, reorganize, rebuild. And it's the process of ebbing and flowing of life is when we really learn who's really in and who's not in. Then we have this question, if that's true, are those tides, that ebbing and flowing of life, naturally occurring events, is the controller behind those tides? Does he have anything to do with it? You know, we who love the Lord, desire to serve Him, really do believe that our Lord is behind every circumstance, every change in life. And we believe that often He is the author of those circumstances as well as the blessed controller of all of these circumstances that we face in life. We really do believe that. And that's why we can enjoy the good times, and that's how we have strength to endure the bad times alike. We do it with confidence, the absolute assurance that we just know God is in control. Okay, that's a really good conclusion. But put yourself in David's sandals, and you might come to a different conclusion. Now, at what point in David's life this rebellion from Absalom occurred, we're just not sure. We know that it was after David's great sin with Bathsheba. I mean, that's obvious. We know that. We know that it was at least 5, maybe 9 years after Absalom's great sin of murdering his brother Amnon. And if we understand human nature at all, we'll probably at least think that during this time when these crises are coming into David's life, and especially this rebellion by Absalom, surely during those times he had to be remembering the promise from God that there were going to be consequences because of his sin. Did he think about that? And is God in charge of those consequences too? You know, if we believe that, we might be just a little bit timid to kind of step up and address an issue that might even become a volatile issue, because if we do, those consequences might cause us to face rebuke and embarrassment. And I think that is probably David's attitude as it lies behind the unfolding of this very tragic event in this story. While God was moving people and circumstances for the express purpose of making David more like himself, the people in the story were just acting like people tend to act. There were some faithful friends, and they stuck by David through thick and thin. There were some fickle friends. They left. But all the people and all the responses were working for the glory of God because he was in control of all of it. Let's look at some of those fickle associations. I think you know that almost without exception, the truth is that unfaithful relationships are just going to fail in the face of deception. That's what happened here in verses 1 through verse 6. You see it. Why? Because those shallow, those weak relationships really can't take pressure. They were never meant to. That's the case regarding Absalom. Yeah, how in the world did he pull off this coup in the first place? Well, he was working with real people. Real people. And so you have this ungrateful, this undisciplined son who's going about laying this foundation of deception in very, very practical ways. This spoiled son is just bringing the people to himself, making himself look very appealing. Look at that first verse. After this, Absalom got for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. Why? Well, to make him look important. He's still very obviously a spoiled child who has grown up to be a man with a child's impulsiveness and unreasonableness, but with a man's passions. What a dangerous combination. And so he intentionally, subtly, not accidentally, intentionally, subtly steals the hearts of the people away from David. Verse 2 makes it very clear that's what he's doing. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way at the gate. When a man had a dispute to come before the king for judgment, Absalom would intervene here. He would call out to him. He'd say, "From what city are you?" "Oh, I'm interested in you." He would say, "What is your servant in such and such a tribe of Israel?" Da-da-da-da. And Absalom would say to him, "See, well, your claims are good. They're right. You got a case. I know that. Too bad the king doesn't know that. Well, I wish there was somebody, maybe even me, in the kingdom who could really take care of you people." You know, years later, David's son, Solomon, warned his son to watch out for people like Absalom. Solomon said, "Identify these people and stay away from them." Proverbs 16:28, "A dishonest man spreads strife and a whisperer separates close friends." That's exactly what Absalom was doing. Proverbs 22:24, "Make no friendship with a man given to anger, nor go with a wrathful man." That's why he's doing this. People should have run away from him. It should have been really obvious that Absalom was a man who hated. I mean, it's very clear he hated Amnon, his half-brother. That's why he killed him, for what he did to his sister. We knew that story, read it, chapter 13. Very similar way. I mean, he manifests that anger. Why? He gives a message to Joab. He says, "Joab, I want to talk to you." Joab says, "I want to ignore you." So what does he do? He burns Joab's barley field. Stay away from a man like that. Nothing but trouble. And again, through this anger, because of this anger, he is intentionally winning the people's hearts over to himself. It wasn't an accident. Absalom was bright enough to realize that through relational circumstances, just this is the way people are. By this time in David's reign, there were going to be plenty of people in the kingdom who had a grievance against the king. Of course that was going to happen. Absalom could see that. He knew that David had made some enemies. Which leader hasn't? But really, I mean, you can't lead without offending somebody. You all know that. I mean, that's just a law of life. It's like the law of physics. The law of physics says you can't move without producing friction. And you can't lead without offending people. And a subtle and a wicked man finds those offended people, those someones, and gathers them together in a coalition against the disliked leader. Now all of you can sit here this morning and say, "Oh, we've seen this story before." Right? I mean, you've seen it everywhere. You've seen it at work. You see it in our nation all the time. You know, a very similar thing to this happened actually in David's life. So he knew about it. Back when Saul determined that he was going to kill David, what did David do? He ran away. Obviously, that was a good thing to do. Where does he go? He goes and hides in the rocks of En-Gedi, the strongholds of En-Gedi. And what happened at that point? 1 Samuel 22, verse 2, "And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul gathered to him, and he became captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men." Disgruntled, discouraged, angry at the king. And this very sequence has been the cause for untold numbers of churches being planted in America and around the world. It's the same everywhere. You thought it was just Greenville. Happens everywhere. This is normal because these are people. This is exactly what happens. And while it's almost always good for us to start new churches, I don't know that it's good to establish them by gathering together everyone who is disgruntled with their current pastor and then splitting a church in order to start another one. If finding disgruntled people is as easy as finding people. I mean, it's not hard to find these folks. Absalom found him. And they didn't ask any questions about him, apparently. Because it's really, really easy for a person who has no track record to promise a suitable and favorable track for people to run on, and the disgruntled people usually buy it. And they take it hook, line, and sinker. Well, as a result of that, in David's life, you had these forgetful people. They just kind of abandoned their relationship with the king who had done so much for them. Verse 5, whenever a man came to pay homage to him, that's Absalom, he would put out his hand. Why are people coming to Absalom to pay homage? Well, he stole their heart. And he would take hold of them and he would kiss them. Oh man, how he loved these people. And Absalom did to all of Israel who came to the king for judgment, and he stole the hearts of the men of Israel. You know, reading this story 3,000 years after it happened, we can almost hear all these people saying things like, "Oh, the king's son, he is such a nice man." I mean, wouldn't you hear people saying that? And not just the old ladies in the dressing in the hair parlor, you know. It's everybody. Oh, what a nice man. Yeah, but what about loyalty to the king who delivered you from all your enemies? Yeah, what about loyalty to the king who gave you a land of peace to live in, who has given you prosperity? What about loyalty to him? It's almost like this new generation grew up just taking for granted all the blessings that the king had fought for to bring those people and secured for them. And they just kind of grew up thinking, well, if they're always there, we always deserve them. I can tell by looking at you folks right now. Some of you are sitting there thinking the word millennial. But the millennials don't think that way. Okay, our millennials don't think that way. They're different. Plenty of them do. You owe us something. And Absalom is the guy who's going to give us what we deserve. And so they forsook loyalty to the king because they honestly thought they owed him nothing. Folks, that kind of forgetfulness is not just thoughtlessness or carelessness. The Bible identifies it as unrighteousness. That kind of forgetfulness is contrary to a spirit toward God. Job said this, "He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty." In other words, if you abandon a friend, it's like you just decided you're not going to have respect for God anymore. You know, this loyalty thing is really serious in the Bible. This is the kind of heart. The Absalom heart is the kind of heart that we find in wicked Judas. And of all people, David actually prophesied about Judas. Psalm 41, verse 9. Even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. Most people think he was talking at that moment about Absalom. But years later, Jesus said, actually, you were talking about Judas. Because in John 13, verse 18, those are exactly the words that Jesus applied to Judas, and he said that scripture might be fulfilled. So how did all the good and faithful people feel? As they're watching their world crumble around them, and it's a disaster. Well, they might have concluded that when a foundation of deception is in place, it's really, really difficult to prevent disaster. See, we don't want that foundation to be laid in the first place. Well, Absalom was successful to lay it. And look at the disaster, verse 7 through verse 12. Well, how do you stop something like that? Well, actually, the beloved Barney Fife had a solution to this. It's real simple. Nip it. Nip it in the bud. Okay, that's a good philosophy. It might even be biblical. Okay? Somebody should have nipped it in the bud. Didn't they see it happening? Yeah, by the end of 4 years of Absalom doing the same thing over and over and over, the subtle theft has taken place, the damage has been done, and his rebellion and stealing the hearts of the people, it should have been obvious. Somebody should have seen it. If David didn't see it, at least one of his counselors should have seen it and come and ratted out Absalom. It's like nobody saw it. David should have known, he should have seen, he should have heard about this, and he should have acted swiftly. Both as authoritative father and authoritative king, he should have done something about it. He didn't. Then we're left to ask this question, why didn't he do something? What would you have done? You know, I wonder if maybe at this point David didn't feel like he had lost his authority as father and as king. It's very obvious from the story that there were a good number of people in his kingdom who felt like David didn't listen to them. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? Obvious also is the fact that his popularity has waned since those early days when they made him the king over both Israel and Judah. In those early days, I think there would have been a lot of folks who would have come knocking on the palace door and said, hey, you got to understand what Absalom is doing out there. Nobody seems to have showed up. And yet I have to believe with all my heart that David was not completely deceived here. Evidence of Absalom's insincerity just lay on the surface of everything. And maybe nowhere is it more obvious in this statement he makes to his father, the king, about this vow. Folks, really, I mean, Lord kind of talk from a deceiver ought to stand out like a sore thumb. But right away, when David heard this, he should say, why? You think I was born yesterday? Verse 7, at the end of 4 years, Absalom says to the king, please let me go pay my vow, which I vowed to the Lord in Hebron. For your servant vowed a vow while I lived in Geshur and Aram, saying, if the Lord will indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, then I'll offer worship to the Lord. Well, now considering who his father was, frankly, there is no surprise here at all that Absalom would have been familiar with Lord kind of talk. And what the Lord expected. I mean, his dad's David, a man after God's own heart. His dad's the one that brought the ark back to Jerusalem. His dad's a worshiper. Absalom was familiar with Lord kind of talk, vow kind of stuff, this kind of stuff that the Lord would expect you to do, which is a very common danger for children who grow up into adulthood as members of God-fearing homes. Folks, this is a great danger. For our children grow up knowing all the lingo, knowing all the language, knowing what's expected, just knowing, okay, this is what a Christian is like. And they know everything except the Lord. And if you don't know the Lord on a personal relationship, all that other stuff doesn't matter. And Absalom proves that to us. You know, rebellion against your father is really a very serious matter in the Bible. But rebellion against God's ordained authority, invoking the name of the Lord while you do it, That's almost inexcusable. It demands special scrutiny. So let's scrutinize. Why? Why did Absalom choose Hebron as the place where he needed to go fulfill this vow? There's a reason for that. You see, as soon as we start answering these questions, we have every right to doubt the veracity of this vow. This is not a vow. This is political expediency. Hebron was several miles from Jerusalem, and so whatever he's doing there, as he starts his kingdom there, as he gets the rebellion in full force there, it's not going to be as obvious, and it's certainly not going to be under the eye of David's soldiers. Hebron makes sense. Oh, by the way, Hebron just happens to be the place where David was crowned king first. Oh. And because David's kingdom actually began in Hebron, but now he's in Jerusalem, do you suppose those people in Hebron might have a certain amount of jealousy toward the people in Jerusalem? If you know people, you know that's probably true. What a great place to start your kingdom. So this vow had nothing to do with Yahweh. It had everything to do with political expedience. Which makes me think that maybe Absalom would actually make a very good candidate for the presidency of the United States. He understands religion, he understands Lord, but he understands political expediency. Well, sadly, this father king who is God's choice was as deceived as the deceiver was. Verse 9, king says to him, "Go in peace." Now, go in peace is really just a simple way of giving the son his blessing. Why did he do that? Was David totally ignorant of Absalom's revealed character? If he understood Absalom's character, why did he say these words? Well, it's contrary to God and his person. This is what the Lord promises. Isaiah chapter 48, verse 22. "There is no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked." Was Absalom wicked? Yes. Is there any peace for Absalom? No. Then why did David tell him to have it? It's easy. Now, why didn't David see what Absalom was doing? Why didn't he set his foot down and just say, "Look, Absalom, you're a murderer, you're a deceiver. I've got two choices, and I'm going to have to do one or the other. I can send you into exile, or I can have you executed. Either one. Now you choose." Well, would you have done that? You see, questions like that really deserve our attention. And an answer, if possible, in a case like that would help us understand not only our own quagmires, but the really difficult situations in which our friends find themselves often. Like what? Do you suppose there's a possibility here that maybe David was suffering from guilt? I really think that plays into this. Assuming that because of his own sin against Bathsheba, against Uriah, he had forfeited any right to impose righteousness on someone else. See, that happens. In fact, the story of David's life, we've studied it week after week, and if you've been able to follow it continuously, maybe you've seen this. The story of David's life after his wicked acts against Bathsheba and Uriah seemed to portray a man without confidence and zeal. It just seems to have gone. It's almost like David started leading from that point on, and maybe it even got worse, where he just kind of had a spiritual and an emotional limp all those last days of his kingship. And if so, then the story of David really is a sad reminder that it is true that few leaders ride off into the beautiful sunset completely successful, like some kind of a John Wayne movie. Leaders' lives so often don't end that way. Much of the time, our western horizons are not beautiful sunsets. They're covered with ominous clouds that offer unanswered questions or discouragement. And we ride off into them. And so the people were left to ask with David, what are we going to do? Maybe they were thinking of something David wrote as a psalmist. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? I mean, the plan's already in place. How are you going to change this? How can you undo this? Verse 10. Absalom sent a secret messenger throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then say, Absalom is king. Verse 11, 200 demonstrators show up. You know, they're clueless. All they know is that somebody gave them a $1,500 check to go to Hebron. They don't know what's going on. They're just part of the group. Because unsuspecting people make great pawns for devious people. That's just a principle of life. Finally, Absalom puts in the final piece of the puzzle. And this was a critical piece. Verse 12. While Absalom was offering the sacrifice, he sent for Ahithophel the Gileonite, David's counselor from the city of Gilam. Conspiracy grew strong. It kept increasing. Absalom sends and gets David's chief advisor, Ahithophel. Why, in the name of common sense, did Ahithophel go with Absalom? Well, there's a really, really good reason. You remember when we studied the Bathsheba story, that we drew the conclusion that it's very, very likely that Ahithophel just happened to be Bathsheba's grandfather. He had every reason to go with Absalom because he lost confidence in David. And maybe he hung on there and gave him advice, and maybe, you know, he's just really, really patient, but now here's the opportunity. And the adversarial winds just drove him right over to Absalom. And the story just kind of presents a picture of this nation unraveling, and it has absolutely no hope. How in the world did this ever happen? I mean, who's really responsible? How incredibly discouraging. Well, folks, what would you think? What would you feel like if you're in this kind of a circumstance? I mean, honestly, at this point, you would probably feel just like you would feel today if Hillary had been elected. It's like, we're hopeless. Maybe we have no idea how hopeless we really are. You know what the good news is? This was actually God's work. It really wasn't Absalom. Yeah, I mean, he seems to be the chief figure, but as we watch these faithful friends who are so in contrast with the fickle friends, we just keep seeing God, just doing His work. Because you have these servants who are really true. I mean, they're really honest, they're really sincere. They're ready to do whatever the king commands. Verse 13, verse 14. He gives them a command. It's real simple. He says, guys, it's time for us to skedaddle. Now, that's a good word. That word came out of the war between the states. In the war between the states, when an army was approaching you and it looked like they were going to break through your lines and you had no choice whatsoever, the commander would say, time to skedaddle. That meant retreat. And that's what David and his servants are going to do. The messenger came to David, said, all the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom. Verse 13. Yikes. And it looked like all of a sudden that God had turned all the tables against His chosen servant. Would God ever do that? I mean, there's this calamity. Look, the bulk of the people have revolted against Him. They're moving to unseat Him from the throne that God had established for Him. Must be God was moving Him out. In fact, maybe David was wondering, is God going to kill the king here? Would God do that? Wouldn't be the first time that happened in history. In fact, it wouldn't be the first time that God would allow a king to be assassinated. It wouldn't be the last time even for the people of Israel. In their waning days, both Israel and Judah, assassinating the sitting king was pretty normal. In fact, David really should have been killed by now because of his sin, but God spared him. What? Would God let him be killed now? Did God change His mind? Second, you have this discovery of this villainy, this hypocrisy, this heartless cruelty of his favorite popular son. Why is that happening? Well, because God promised there would be upheaval in David's own family. This is what upheaval looks like. And probably this is the most discouraging. You think about it, what is more discouraging than a child rebelling against you. Many of you know what that feels like. It's where David was. Third, there's a discovery of the hearts of the people that they'd gone over to Absalom. I mean, these are people David loved. These are people David fought for. These are people David protected. He gave things to. And how do they show love for him? They turn to this sinister son who's the usurper of the throne. Well, there's only one option, apparently. Verse 14, David says to all his servants who are with him, "Arise, let us flee. Time to skedaddle. There's no escape. We stay here. Absalom's going to come in. He's going to destroy the city. I don't want that to happen." So all the servants pass by the king. They're ready to do whatever he says. Verse 15, the king's servants said to the king, "Behold, your servants are ready to do whatever the Lord decides." They're tightly connected. His fear is their fear. His flight is their flight. His loss is their loss. I'm sure there are a lot of people who had position titles as servants of the king, and they're all over with Absalom right now, but not these people. They're dependable. The winds of favor didn't make any difference to them. They're real servants. You see, a fickle commitment, which is no commitment at all, is just a flaw of sinful nature. And that's why Jesus said, you know, really, if you show that kind of a heart in your relationship with me, that indicates there's really no relationship there whatsoever. Right? What did Jesus mean, Mark 8:35? Whosoever will save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. Is that what it costs? That's faithfulness. So does it really matter if you stick with your relationships through thick and thin? Absolutely. It really does matter. Because it's very, very much like godliness. Proverbs 17:17, a friend loves at all times. A brother is born for a time of adversity. You see, this time of adversity proved who were the people who had a heart for God and therefore a heart for the king. God's plan. God's reward for people who are faithful, especially to the King of Kings. Folks, it's out of this world. Literally. This is what Jesus taught. You are of those who have stayed with me in my trials. I assigned you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom. Wow. That you may eat and drink at my table with my kingdom, sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. That's what the disciples got for being faithful. God loves faithfulness. Because there's no greater example of it than King Jesus himself. And we're supposed to be like him. David even wrote this, Psalm 25, "The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant." He loves being our friend. He's going to be faithful. And that's why when you start to review those friends who are faithful to you, especially when you're in a time of difficulty and you're going through these trials, and maybe they are even trials that we deserve, definitely trials that God sends, when we remember we have friends, it is so encouraging. So here stands King David. Everything's unraveling around him. The kingdom's going to pot. It's really his own fault. And all his friends start walking by. Verse 16, the king went out, all his household after him. He left 10 concubines back at the house, and the king went out and all the people after him. And they halted at the last house. It appears they're going out of Jerusalem. They come to the last house in Jerusalem proper before they cross over Brook Kidron and start up the Mount of Olives. They stop there. And here go these servants, faithful friends, all walking by. And some of the first ones who go by are the people David's going to need so much in this time of crisis. Who are they? They're warriors. And all his servants pass by, verse 18, all the Kerethites, the Pelethites, 600 Gittites. Now those 600 Gittites, I think, is a reference to those people who gathered around him when he was in the stronghold of En-Gedi. And then he goes over to Gath, and you remember that episode in Gath that turned out to be a fiasco where he did not pull off a good friendship with the king of the Philistines. And his people were there with him. Those warriors were there with him in Gath. And then they all left from Gath. And now they're still with him. And faithful people for many years. People like that who are just willing to sacrifice to protect you. Folks, those are valuable, valuable friends. You can't put a price on people like that. Alexander McLaren wrote it like this. He said, "Amid the faithless, a few were found faithful. Friends in such need are friends indeed. And the sight of their honest, though perplexed countenances, and the sound of their friendly, though trembling voices would be most soothing to his feelings and serve to rally the energy that had almost left him. And when the world forsakes us, the few friends that remain are of priceless value." Do you ever find that to be true? There were his warriors with him. "We're here, David. We were with you in Gath. We were with you in Gedi. We were with you against Saul. We're still with you." But boy, somebody needs to stay back in Jerusalem, right? Yeah, they're really helpful friends, like Ittai. What a faithful friend. This guy shows up. David says, "Look, you've only been here a little short time. Why don't you go home?" And the guy says, "I'm not going to do it." Now, what an amazing loyalty. He hardly knows David. Verse 20. Sounds to me like Ruth saying to Naomi, "Wherever you go, I go. Your friends are my friends. Your people are my people. I'm with you." What an encouragement. And Abiathar and Zadok, you have these priests and the Levites. They come up and they bring the ark with them and they're in charge of worship. You know, they've been in charge of worship. They're in Jerusalem and they've been in charge of watching over the ark and the symbol of God's presence. And they bring it with him. And probably David's thinking, "Wait a minute, I remember a story like this. Long before my time, back in Samuel's day, that ark got stolen at a battle against the Philistines. We're not going to let that happen again. You guys take it back to Jerusalem. By the way, you'll be more helpful to me back there. And I just like to believe that God's going to be really good to me and He's going to restore me to Jerusalem and I'll come back. I'll worship at the ark. Oh, by the way, you'll make good informers." Let's be practical about these things. But maybe the most important friend to show up at this time was Hushai. It was told David in verse 31 that Ahithophel was among the conspirators. Boy, that would have been discouraging. Life's unraveling. There's no easy answers to what's going on. He's walking out of his city. He's going up the Mount of Olives. And here he finds out that his famous advisor, who is so famous for giving advice, it sounds like the word of God himself, he's turned against him. For good reason. What are you going to do? At a time like that, do you get discouraged? Do you get depressed? What do you turn to? You don't even dare turn to friends because they've forsaken you. Do you turn to substances? What do you turn to? Boy, when David heard the worst news that he could possibly hear in this whole episode, he prayed. He prayed a very specific prayer. "Oh Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." What in the world? Really, if you know anything about Ahithophel, you know that he has a reputation that when he speaks, he is speaking God's words. I mean, it's like the Lord Himself spoke. Come on, David. Can't you come up with a better prayer than this? This one isn't going to work. Because we know, historically, the facts are in. When Ahithophel speaks, God speaks. You think that God's going to confuse a man like that? David says, "I'll ask Him to. You're expecting a miracle." And no sooner was that prayer out of his mouth than a miracle showed up. What an amazing thing. And along comes Hushai, who is also a counselor. He just happens to show up at that moment. You know what we're going to study in the next weeks as we continue this series with David? God uses this very man to answer that precise prayer against all common sense and expectations. What an amazing God. Yeah, right now it looks like life's falling apart. It looks like there's no hope. It looks like there's no help. But folks, really, God had promised David that stuff like this was going to happen. He was going to have days of discipline. Should he get angry with God during those times? Should he abandon God? Should he say, God, you're not fair? God, I confess, you forgave. Why this? This isn't right. No, we shouldn't respond like that. We should respond exactly like David. Yeah, the tough times come, the difficult times come. Sometimes we don't even understand why they come. In those times we worship God. We pray for God's help. We rejoice in the friends that God sends us. And we press on to do His will. You see, that's why God arranges these things the way He does. And in that story we've just read about this whole episode of David's life and kingdom unraveling, he still holds to his confidence in God. And he said, I will pray to God. One day I'm coming back to Jerusalem to worship at the presence of God. And I'm going to rejoice in the friends that God has sent me. Folks, that's how we respond in those testing times. Now, even when you're like David and you say, I know why this is happening. Okay, fine. But you pray to God. And you worship God. And you rejoice in the friends that God sends. Hey, and by the way, be one of those friends. Be a Hushai. Be an Ittai. You know? Be a Gileonite. A Kerethite. Okay? Maybe that'd make a good organization in Community Baptist Church, the Kerethites. We care for those people who are going through trouble.